Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Expanding freedom and democracy are what America has always been about. You're the voice of American exceptionalism.
This is the Debunking Economics Podcast with Steve Keen and Phil Dobby.
Well, that was Mike Pompeo a few years ago, who was Secretary of State under Donald Trump, you might remember, still using that term, American exceptionalism. And it's still used today, mainly by Americans, and increasingly lately, because their economy is doing better than most, and their share market is on a bit of a bender. Why? Because America is exceptional. Didn't you hear that? So is this hiding the truth? Let's entertain the notion today that America isn't exceptional and rising shares don't mean an improving economy, although they are seeing more growth than just about anybody else. So that is the exception. So maybe they have a case. That's this week on the Debunking Economics Podcast. Well, we know it's hard not to do what America expects of you. I mean, militarily, the West relies on them to step up to the plate when all those countries who haven't spent as much on defense can't get by themselves on their own. But that means, of course, we surrender our own political agenda for whatever it is that America believes in, which can be hard to fathom at times. For example, Elon Musk is already speaking out against spending money on Ukraine, saying that we'll never beat Russia, so just let them win. And you know what Elon says, Donald is sure to follow. So there's a foretaste of what we can expect at the end of the year. But that aside, what about the reliance on America in terms of business and finance? Let's take the equity markets as a good example. So the US share market has a market cap that amounts to 70% of all the world's totally listed market cap. 70% of all money spent on shares is spent on shares in America. Now, if that sounds a lot, because it is. In 2008, which isn't that long ago, it was way less than 50%. So what's changed? Well, to a large extent, the Magnificent Seven. So Meta's share price is up over 150% in the last 12 months. Alphabet or Google not doing quite as well, but they're still up 50% over the year. Microsoft is about the same, and so is Netflix. Amazon up 70% in the last 12 months, all in a time when the S&P generally just rose 20%, well below the levels of big tech. So, Steve, this is a problem, isn't it? If one country dominates, let's just look at equities first of all. If one country dominates, arguably the future, because people are investing in how they expect these companies are going to do, if you dominate in such a big way, that becomes a problem for everybody else, not for America, of course. They're loving it.
Yeah, I mean, I have a general picture about this American exceptionalism, and I'll give a couple of anecdotes, because it's something which isn't just restrained to the stock market. It was just the stock market. You know, you say that casino is dominated by, you know, fly-ins from America rather than fly-ins from China, essentially fly in Australia. But to me, it's a casino. You know, and you could ignore it. You could ignore it otherwise. But it's in everything, and it permeates the culture of America, and it permeates how they affect foreign relations, military interventions, everything else. So I had one of the personal anecdote about that. A guy applied to do a PhD with me at Kingston, and he was supposed to do some particular form filling. I've forgotten what it was. And he hadn't done it, so I just reminded him. He wrote back to me saying, oh, I believe in American exceptionalism, and everything I look at, I think, well, does this really apply to me as an American? And I said, right, you're not going to be my PhD student. I do not want that mindset to be lying between me and you talking over intellectual issues. He was outraged. How dare you not take on an American? I said, because you're an American and you believe you're exceptional. And I think this applies to their politics in general. And a phrase I saw this, you know, in my own youth in the 70s when you had the Vietnam War coming to an end, thank God. But the attitude of America to everything was effectively the same as a house owner to what happens in the backyard. Why is that weed growing in my backyard? And I coined the term not American exceptionalism, but the parochiality of empire. And an empire sees everything in the rest of the world as disobeying what the owner of the rest of the world, that's why I use the house and the backyard analogy, wants to have done. And they plunge into issues where they have no understanding of why, for example, it was a bad idea to invade Iraq when there were two major religiously based factions in the country, Shia and Shiite, and you had a minority governing a majority, and not knowing what they were going to do when they interjected their Western Anglo-American attitudes into an internally conflictual system, which itself was created by the British. I mean, you just get a cascade of ignorances about the rest of the world, and they see everything from their perspective, and it's no damn wonder they stuff up the bloody planet.
Right, good. And it continues. I mean, you know, that whole, you know, fighting over Islamic factions continues, doesn't it? And it's so you put your fingers into that game, and you're never going to win. And we are experiencing that right now, obviously, in terms of, you know, Iran basically controlling multiple wars on multiple fronts. And America is obviously in on all of that. But let's not talk about the military, because, I mean, that's a different discussion. Let's just talk about American money and American and American business.
American money, that sounds like a song.
if you are a startup and you've got a great idea, you almost have to go to America, because America is where you're going to get the finance. It's where the market is. It's where it's where you've got to start, in a way. It's very hard, isn't it, to start a business in Australia or the UK. Really, if you've got a great tech idea in particular, you've almost got to move to Silicon Valley.
Yeah, and like I've got personal experience of that right now. We're trying to develop Ravel, which I'll be talking about more as we get closer and closer to doing a commercial launch of it. But yeah, the first, you don't, because you have that enormous volume of money you mentioned, of course, dominated by the Tech 7 at the moment, then it's almost automatic that if you want to get something started in tech, you're going to find it easier if you can manage to knock on an American door than if you try knocking on an Australian one. And I've also had direct personal experience of that. So because the money is in, the share of valuation, the explosive increase in valuations and the marketing and so on is centered around America, then that becomes where you've got to go. And it's actually, there's a theory in economics, but one of the few things worth learning in conventional economics, which is respected by conventional economists, is called the hoteling hypothesis. And that is that if you look at the spread of industries on a geographic basis, you don't get a perfect market outcome. The usual neoclassical stuff says, you know, leave it to the market, you'll get a perfect balance, and that's full of more crap than I have time to discuss today. But hoteling's idea was, imagine you had a beach on which there was an ice cream. As the very first ice cream distributor, where's a sensible location that the people evenly distributed along the beach. Then you whack it right in the middle of the beach. Then you have a competitor turning up. Now, what's the ideal situation for the people on the beach in terms of customers are buying ice cream? Well, that's you have them at the one-third of the beach and two-third of the beach location, which means nobody has...
Yeah, and we've covered this before, but they both sit next
together.
To
they all go next to each other, and they get half the beach each, and you have... Sure. Yeah, so this is...
And that is what we're seeing with it. Well, it's what we're seeing with the tech industry, isn't it? Absolutely. But, I mean, it's not just necessarily being in America, is it? It's just that you need to be... You know, if you want to get listed, you want to get listed on those exchanges. So, you know, we've got companies that are not necessarily American companies that want to list on the American Stock Exchange. So they move to America for that to happen. And then you get this big inflow of capital as well going into the United States with people buying those shares, not necessarily American money that's flowing into the U.S. as well. So you talk about it being a casino, but I mean, which obviously it is, but also it is helping to raise capital for some businesses as well. And it's not necessarily American money that's flowing into there. It's a mix of American money and money coming from overseas.
And this is what gives you an overview. Again, this has got all sorts of other consequences as well, because it certainly means if you're looking in the tech world, then yes, you get Indian rupees get converted into American dollars so that you can capitalize your company in the United States of America, which is demand for American dollars. And that, for as well as meaning that gives the financial and the stock market side of America immense power, it also means that the American dollar is massively overvalued for manufacturers trying to export in the opposite direction. So it helps out the financial system, but it hollows out the industrial system of America.
Yeah, and I don't know what they do about that. And for it being a casino, where would you imagine the largest net purchasers of US assets? Well, let's just look at stocks. The largest net purchaser, where in the world do you reckon most of the money comes from? And this is in 2022, and I haven't got the exact figure. Looking on a graph, it looks like it's about $170 billion worth of investment in that year in US stocks. Where do you reckon it comes from?
Oh, boy, you've got me here.
Well,
I'd be jumping China or India, and my third better be Europe. But I'm certainly no, well, this, in the
this,
dark
this,
here.
This just shows how it's a game that you and I will never play in.
Yeah,
it's the Cayman Islands.
Oh Jesus! Okay, of course, tax haven. Okay,
yeah.
Oh my God! Have you ever been to a tax haven?
No. Okay. But I understand there's an address which has got like 50 businesses, and there's
I'm trying to remember this. It was the two marriages ago. But with my first wife, we went to, I think it was the Cayman Islands, and this is back in the late 1990s, and we went there for snorkeling, and to add to the drama, she left our paddy cards behind, so we ended up going in one of the Abyss submersibles instead. But we went to that building, and I don't think I took a photograph, unfortunately. This is before digital cameras. But there were it was a whitewashed two-story building about the size of a reasonably well-off, a McMansion sort of size, not a large McMansion, like, what they call the medium-sized McDonald hamburger. And there were 50 or 60 plaques on the door, including News Limited and quite a few others, and no one was home. And that building is probably where most of the investment money is coming from. This is money laundering. And this is another thing that casinos, we try as much as we can to stop actual casinos from doing money laundering. But the stock market is clearly enabling money laundering. So the wealthy are keeping the wealth to themselves.
Yeah. Yeah.
Cayman Island. What's number two?
For stocks, it would be, just as an aggregate, Middle East oil exporters.
Okay. Yeah, fair. Then, I should have thought of them. Yeah.
Then Singapore. Then China, I should say. Then Singapore, then Germany.
Oh, well.
Luxembourg pulled out a lot of money that year. So actually a negative in terms of...
Well, that's where you go to live.
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, jeez. I mean...
So
the Cayman Islands. I should have known.
I know, but I mean, what a staggering figure, $170 billion in 1 year. So I mean, we've got, and of course, China, meanwhile, is just not attracting investment at all. So I'm just wondering whether this is a bad sign for the future that you've got this yawning chasm now between US and China in terms of equity share. And the US is claiming more and more, so there's more investment going into tech. And these big tech players, as we were talking about with Giannis a few weeks ago, are just dominating so much of society. Like, you can't buy anything that's not Amazon. Amazon's got, 50% of the retail share in the United States? And actually, not the biggest. I mean, we can talk about that in a moment. But it's just the idea that so much is now getting dominated by tech, and America is dominating tech. And there's nobody else gets a look in. I don't know how you get around that problem.
Yeah, well, again, the point you're making about the Cayman Islands is a major issue there. I'm kicking myself for not nominating a tax haven immediately. But yeah, what we have is people are evading tax. Now, that this is where the MMT point comes in. It's not that means they're not funding public enterprises, though that. It means that if there's pressure to reduce the tax take, which means reduce the scale of government activity in general, with a smaller gap. It's the gap between tax and spending that creates fiat money. Now, if you need a substantial amount of tax in the first place to have the public services that we also take for granted in more advanced countries than America. The Scandinavian countries and some of the higher tax take also have much, much higher provision of public services. But what you have is by people evading taxes, they're meaning that the money that the government creates and injects into the system is taken out of our bank accounts, the poor, not the wealthy's bank accounts. So they accumulate additional money over and above what they should in terms of taxable income, and then put that back into ownership of more shares again. So it's a concentration process, concentration of wealth.
And that concentration of wealth is elevating the price of those assets.
Yeah, again, so it's a feedback process, which means, of course, they come back, and then if they're not going to be paying tax with the money, they're not going to be putting their money back into tax, destroying money that way. They're going to accumulate that money and put into ownership of further capital resources, which further enhances the inequality that, is possibly
so
the most defining feature of the system we live in.
Yeah, and it's so clear in America. I mean, going to Chicago last year, I was shocked thinking that this is a first world country.
Yeah.
And the gap between the very rich and the, with my relatives, who one of whom boasted about the fact he keeps his air conditioning on in his house in Florida, even when he's not living there, just to keep the house cool.
Yeah.
And then seeing the poverty on the streets in Chicago, it's staggering.
It is staggering. I must give myself time to sit down and listen to the Putin interview with what's that American politician who went there and
I've forgotten his name. Not a politician. The
journalist,
ex Fox News guy.
Okay. He was stunned by the subways in Russia, which I've been in, and they're stunning. They're beautiful works of art. And this is because
Tucker Carlson is the guy talking about.
Because
not been anywhere else. He's not been outside America.
And
he thinks
the American subway is standard. Now, if I had to think the two ugliest subways in the planet, it'd be New York number one and London number two.
Well,
London Police has quirks in its favour.
Yeah, and you haven't been on the Elizabeth line,
huh?
Steve.
The Elizabeth line's gorgeous. That's what you find in France. You find it in the Netherlands. You find it in most European countries with a higher tax take. Also, higher government spending above that again, which they're mistakenly trying to reduce. But you need that so that you provide the public what was once described by John Kenneth Galbraith. You should have public affluence. Okay, you said what we get instead is private affluence and public squalor. And American cities are just a sign of what happens when you don't have a large enough tax take, as well as don't have enough government spending on top over and above the tax level. So they go somewhere else in the world and they see how bloody awful their public system is, and you need that to have a civilized society.
Yeah. So it is a quirk, isn't it? Here you've got people who are avoiding tax, as you say, money that could. I mean, okay, we know how the tax system really works. People are avoiding paying tax, so that's seen as a reason for not spending as much on public services, and that money is being spent to buy up more equities, which is pushing up the value of equities. Does that really matter, in terms of the scheme of things? So I guess as we go to this break, America's seeing this big increase in its share of all the equities in the world. Do we care too much, or is it just creating an inequality that is America's problem more than anyone else's?
It's twofold, because to a large degree, the equity market should be where capital is created, but it's often where speculative ownership is created rather than new investment. But there is a bit of the new investment which is captured courtesy of that huge dominance of the American market. But in general, it shows we rely far too much on letting the activities of a casino determine the development of societies. And that was Keynes's old point from back in the 1930s. And if you look at what happened when we went from a period where we didn't put the stock market front and center, which is the 50s and 60s, to where we have done that, the 70s in particular, the 80s, the economic growth rate should have increased because we've got more private creation of capital, blah, blah, blah. In fact, when you look over the global system, the rate of economic growth was about 1.5 to 2 times higher under the so-called constipated Keynesian policies than it was when the neoclassicals came over and exalted the stock market above everything else.
All right.
Okay, loads of questions on that. When we come back, it's the Debunking Economics podcast. Me and Steve Keen. Stay with us.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
This is the Debunking Economics podcast with Steve Keen and Phil Dobby.
So, Steve, we were talking just before the break, and we won't just talk about the equity markets, but let's just finish off on that, the fact that it has increased so much, particularly the Magnificent Seven in the US, because tech has been doing so well. And we talked about, you know, how a lot of that clearly has been elevated by tax dodging and that so much money is coming from the Cayman Islands. American money, probably, isn't it? This has come into American stocks versus the Cayman Islands. I raise the question as to whether we really care. Is it just damage that America is doing to itself? So if it is... And we're seeing less invested in European shares, for example. Is the European economy really losing out, or does it really make no difference to the European economy? So we're looking at growth, for example, because obviously America is growing much better than everybody else. Is that in any way tied to the fact that are seeing greater investment?
That is more, and this comes down to a different issue, and it's actually much more MMT aligned as well. European countries are obsessed with getting their budget deficits below 3% of GDP. The Americans have been, under Biden, and this have to say this is possibly a certain credit for Stephanie Kelton's capacity to convince a large number of leading Democrats that they shouldn't be worried about the deficit. America is still creating fiat money by having a substantially larger government deficit, and that is counteracting the deflationary impact of higher private rates on private credit creation. So when you look at the aggregate money creation by the fiat system on the one hand and credit system on the other, America is still running substantially positive, whereas Europe is so obsessed with getting negative and reducing government deficits, are running surpluses rather than deficits, and their credit system is also affected by the high rates, so you're not getting the same rate of credit money creation overall. You've got higher money creation in America, and you get a high rate of growth of the capitalist economy. Europe is lower because it's crucifying itself by not understanding fiat money creation and not understanding credit money creation either.
So very easy to fix that balance then, isn't it? Just invest more money in the public sector in Europe. Problem solved. And we talked about that in terms of money creation last week. But what also about the domination of the US dollar? So let me give you some numbers on that. So there's 21 trillion. If we look at M2, for definition of M2, we've heard of last week's episode. Yeah. There's 21 trillion in US dollars for a country of 330 million people. That's 63,000 per person, just a bit below the average wage, although not everyone works, of course. Mm-hmm. Very old people don't work. Babies, even in America, don't work. We look at 3.8 trillion in US dollars in terms of the UK money supply, M2 money supply, for a country of 67 million. That's 58,000 per person. Not too dissimilar, given how much the US dollar is used overseas. 2 trillion US dollars for Australia, for a country of 26 million. That's 77,000, actually more than the United States. I looked at all those numbers and I was thinking, right, we're going to see, because the American dollar is used so much, we're going to see that there is so much more US dollars in circulation. But actually, that's not the case. When we look at the money supply as a whole, when we look at notes and coins, it's a very, very different story. The US dollar's flooding many parts of the world. But in terms of total money supply, the US is not actually, you know, look at it on related to the population. The US actually is not that much more. There's not that much more money in circulation. Does that surprise you?
Not particularly. I mean, I don't think it's as relevant as people would like it to be in conventional economic theory. If you look at how Bernanke tried to explain the Great Depression, it was largely over the ratio of gold to base money and base money to M1 and M1 to M2 and so on and so forth, and relating all of those to GDP. It's really that it's the level of turnover of the money is an essential, and so is, of course, they don't understand credit money creation, so they're not looking at the scale of money created by the banking sector. And let's also not forget, America is not the world's most prosperous country on a per capita basis. The Scandinavian, I don't know where it sits in the global scale these days, but it's down about number 10 or 15 in per capita income. So I'm not amazed to see it having a lower level of money per capita either.
Until you start looking at cash. So almost 10% of all US currency is cash.
Come again? You know, how much of
10%
of US money, you mean, not currency?
Yeah, okay. in terms of notes and coins, 10% of all of that M2 supply is cash.
Whereas, that's another funny piece of American exceptionalism. And this is backwards.
4% in the UK, 4% in most, 3 or 4% in most countries, but 10% in
America. That's backwards exceptionalism. And this one thing, again, I find quite remarkable. There's so many quirks to America. If you try to interpret it just as a capitalist nation, you're going to fall over on so many different details. It's a religious nation. It's a militaristic nation as well. And you've got to combine all those components together to try to make sense of the place. But I remember going through America, this is the early 2000s, and a good friend was in the neighboring state of the plane. I couldn't go and visit him, but I thought I'd give him a telephone call. And this is back in the days when you still had physical phones to make calls. And I found one, and it said, okay, this call will be, you know, 5-minute call, will be $6.75. Please insert $6.75 in quarters. And I went, what? Quarters? And the Americans will not change out of their bloody useless banknotes, which are all the same size and all the same color. The great blind pianist singer Ray Charles insisted on being paid in $1 notes because that way he couldn't be defrauded. Whereas every other country has notes that are different sizes and coins, 25-cent coins. I mean, you can find similar denomination value coins where I've been in Budapest recently. But, you know, Australia abolished the 5-cent coin, what, 20 years ago? 30 years ago, and the coins have kept pace with inflation. American coins and notes haven't kept pace with inflation. And at the same time, let's get back to our favourite topic here. It's a great way to launder money when it's physical rather than electronic. So yeah. America's, you know, it's stuck. You cannot get Americans to make larger coins. $1 coins. You know, I think the main place we can buy $1 coins is Ecuador. You can't find machines to use $1 coins in America. They don't change their vending machines. So, like, exceptionalism can be backwards as well.
Well, yeah. I mean, having said that, so a couple of stories coming out of that. One is, I'm just imagining Ray Charles getting paid in dollar notes. I mean, if he was around today, he'd be getting paid at least $10,000 a night, wouldn't he? He's going to be up all night counting his money.
He wasn't going to be defrauded. He found quite a few times he'd go to put money in the bank and be told he thought he was depositing, you know, $1,000. And he would find the only depositing 100, you know.
So I'm talking about blind performance. I saw Stevie Wonder, who was on stage. This was in Australia years and years ago. He was absolutely superb with an amazing backing band, a big brass section. So his band was on. Then he came onto the stage and he was carried onto the stage by two bouncers who put him in the middle of the piano. And he started playing, and it was just awful. And he just told everyone to stop. And then the bouncers came back on again and moved him into the right position on the piano. Because they basically put him in the wrong position. So he's playing all the wrong keys. It was just a joke until they put him in the right place. And then he was fine from that point onward. So that was fine. Anyway, just as an aside. But look, the reason why there's so much money, though, so much more cash, is because it's being used in so many more parts of the world as well. So the American dollar is not just being used within America. And you might be right that it's used more because there's more of a reliance. Although I have to say, I went in the middle of last year to Chicago, as I've mentioned. We didn't change any cash. We just relied on cards. Yeah. So we got by without the American dollar. Vending machines, yes, there's one at the airport which took cards and asked for a tip.
Are you kidding?
On a vending machine. Yeah, would you like to leave? You know, with the default, it seems to be everywhere, 18.5% is the minimum tip for a vending machine.
Oh, that's priceless. But
this 10% of currency, isn't a lot of that going to be because the American dollar is being used in so many other parts of the world
and it's being used in cash? I mean, it depends on the stats, whether your stats were actually American dollars in currency in circulation in America or globally. I think this is globally.
Yeah,
okay,
yeah.
Well, globally, I mean, when you've got countries where people don't trust the domestic currency, so Argentina and places like that, you have a secondary market in dollars as well as the local market in whatever the local currency is. So that's, and that again, you know, another huge mistake coming out of Harry Dexter White overruling Keynes and getting us a domestic currency rather than an international currency for international trade. But yeah, that's a major part of it. And also, it's again, money laundering and proceeds of crime, all this stuff is best handled with American dollars than with any other currency because it is the international currency.
So there we are. So another example of American exceptionalism. It's if you are trying to defraud people, then it's the currency to use. Let's look at this word exceptionalism because it seems to be used a great deal again lately because of the strength of the share market and the strength of the tech sector. But you made the point. If you look at GDP per capita, they're well down the table, if that's the best measure anyway. But in the United States, is number 7. Number 1, understandably, is, you know, Monaco, Liechtenstein, all the tax-dodged countries, yeah. Luxembourg, mm. Bermuda. Yep. All got something in common, haven't they? Then you get into Ireland, obviously doing quite well because it's...
Similar tax dodge.
It's tax dodge for companies. And Switzerland, mm-hmm. similarly, nice bank account. Norway, Cayman Islands. Norway's the first country that actually
starts to emerge. Country.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then Singapore, where we're back where we were, and Qatar, and then the United States. When you take out the tax dodge countries, actually they are quite high up. But look, on other measures like health.
Income comes in as well.
Then you've got a real problem. But then if you also look at the, you know, world trade, so they're not, I mean, you know, they're a big country, they're the world's largest economy, but they are, 11% of world trade. I mean, they're not exactly dominating.
70% of world stock market, yeah.
Yeah, doesn't make a great deal of sense, does it?
Well, the stock market itself doesn't make sense. And this is, and I was actually talking on one of my lecture courses about this with a new arrival, and that is that shares themselves should not be open-ended. Because they're open-ended, you can get these crazy valuations coming out of them. And that then means people buy them as speculative vehicles, not as vehicles to enable actual capital formation to occur. So I proposed, well back before the financial crisis, that we should remake shares in what are called jubilee shares. When you buy them initially, which is initial public offering, so you are giving money to the company, then they last forever if you don't sell them. But as soon as you sell them, they've got a 30-year use-by date. They expire after 30 years, which would mean that you would therefore be forced to consider what is the income stream going to be over the next 30 years of this share, back in the days when I thought we had 30 years to think about. And that would mean that you are focusing on the dividend flow, which, according to conventional theory, that's what shares are based on. Of course, that's crazy. It is share prices are based on expectations of capital gains, which again leads to this whole inflationary problem in asset prices. They're not based on what you expect the income stream to be out of those companies, and that's why it can get incredible crashes when, you know, after a while, the delusion that a share is going to be worth, you know, 10 or 100 times its price in 10 years time from today, it collapses. Then the bubble bursts and you have, you know, I'm actually reading the Doonesbury cartoons right now, which about a 20 year lag on the real world, between 20 and 25 years, and they're in the middle of the dot-com bubble, and you're getting these, you know, valuations like pets.com, which at one stage was worth more than, you know, all the retailers in America, disappeared, and all these things, huge valuations crash, and this is the whole gambling.
I wonder whether we're there again with AI, because all of these are being artificially inflated by AI talk, and I just wonder whether it's another dot-com hype and we're going to see another crash because
we
of
could
that.
Well, I mean, there's the huge, I mean, when you look at the type of thing with AI does, I use AI for note-taking in my my lectures these days, and they're great, at a level of having an automated secretary that does the work which you normally say, can somebody else take notes here, please? I mean, nobody wanted the job, and it was always poorly done, and now you get quite a brilliant summary. AI for diagnosis, AI for transportation. There are so many areas which it will have quite a dramatic impact, but still, like the whole dot-com bubble, it'll be overhyped in terms of current valuations.
So this idea that shares start to lose value the moment you start to trade on the secondary market, I mean, the advantage of that, obviously, that does sort of get over this hoteling type principle that you're talking about, where if you want to invest, you've got to invest in the United States. And you do that because you expect you're going to see the share price rise so much more there because there's so much more speculation via the Cayman Islands, as we were discussing.
You take it out of the equation,
If you take that out of the equation, then then you might get to the situation where somebody could, in Europe, for example, say, well, yeah, we've got a great idea. Let's list in Europe because, you know, we're going to get the same level of investment as in the United States. We're going to see the same increase in the value of shares as we would in the United States. That drive for all shares to go to the United States might start to disappear.
And you'd also get more genuine capital formation coming out of it, because the main way you're going to make money is by finding that company which actually is going to generate a permanent income flow over time, rather than the one who you think everybody's going to do the hot potato routine on, which is what you get instead. So Keynes described the stock market as being like a beauty contest, where the prize is given, where you're going to say you're supposed to, of course, looking at only at women, you've got to pick the 10 most beautiful women out of a list of 100, and the prize goes to the person who guesses what the majority opinion is. And he says you don't win by picking the most beautiful person, or even the person that most other people think is going to be picked by others as the most beautiful person. You've got to pick the person who most of people think other people are going to think is the most beautiful person. And he called it the madness of the third degree. And I think that aptly describes how stock markets actually behave. And the fact that we don't reform them shows how little they are to about capital creation.
So we're not saying, basing our valuations on a company based on what we think the company is worth, we're basing it on what we think other people think it's worth.
No, what other people think it's going to be worth.
No.
It's a three-stage, and this is where you get the absurd bubbles and crashes coming out of it, rather than people saying, this is really interesting technology, we need to develop this. That's what an intelligent society would be doing.
Right. So is this bubble in equities, is that hiding what could be a dangerous position for America then? Because if we look at world trade, I mean, so actually in 2022, the total trade in goods and services in billions for the US was $6.7 trillion. The European Union, $8.1 trillion. China, $7.1 trillion. So if you look at international trade, they're third place.
Yeah. And this comes back to the extent to which that money speculation on stock markets is turning to physical capital, and also the competitiveness of the technology you're producing with the rest of the world's physical capital. And it's clearly that America's great at creating paper wealth, but it's not creating long-term capital assets, which are the form in which we actually can produce physical goods and services to give us the genuine standard of living. I mean, again, living up the climate change issues, as I have to whenever I talk about this stuff these days. But it is not a way of doing capital formation. It's a way of speculation, and it ends up with wasted capital being created out of it because people are forced to put some of that huge paper valuation into physical capital, which then is overinvested, useless, loses money, boom, crash. We're back in the boom, crash opera.
Yeah, okay. Rather than producing stuff which could be exported, which could help America's trade position. So its share of global GDP, by the way, 40% in 1960. Obviously, since 1960, global GDP has increased a great deal, so that partially explains this figure. But it's gone from 40% in 1960 to just 24% now. In the same time, China's gone from 4% to 16%. Of course, the rest of the world has skyrocketed. So, you know, at the turn of the century, GDP, global GDP was 35 trillion. Now it's close to 90 trillion. But America is a declining share of that world trade, even if it is an increasing share of the equity markets. So two very different things.
And that's come back to the point you started with. It's actually destructive of America to have these overvalued stock markets.
Yeah, yeah. And even when you look at, you know, things that in the tech sector, where you think, well, okay, they're dominating, and clearly they are. But will they do that forever? So if there is a collapse in shares, what does that do for the you know, if the valuation of those businesses fall, how does that change the enthusiasm for those companies to invest further and to expand, or does it give opportunities elsewhere? So you look at Amazon, for example, and it accounts for half of all the e-commerce in America, you know, compared to Apple, for example, which is 4% of all e-commerce in America. So it's huge in America, but it's small compared to Alibaba. So $239 billion for, in terms of global sales for Amazon, compared to $765 billion for Alibaba. So we talk about American exceptionalism, but that's fine, so long as we ignore China, perhaps.
That's a mistake China's been, America's been making for about 40 years now.
So it could all change, couldn't it? It could all turn. I'm just wondering whether, and is it the equity market that's going to cause that change?
Yeah, I think it's going to be manifest in the equity market rather than caused by the equity market.
I'm not sure what have we declared. American exceptionalism is a myth, perhaps.
No, well, the mental belief in it, it's certainly real. But whether exceptionalism leads to exceptional performance is another story entirely. And what you're pointing out at the end there is that the exceptional performance of the stock market is not at all mirrored in the performance of the physical economy. And that's where, you know, other ways of creating capital, other ways of bringing about investment are more successful than the casino approach America has gone for.
Very good. Very clear. Good to talk. We'll catch you again next week. Thank you.
Welcome, mate. Okay, bye.
The Debunking Economics Podcast.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
If you've enjoyed listening to Debunking Economics, even if you haven't, you might also enjoy The Y Curve. Each week, Roger Hearing and I talk to a guest about a topic that is very much in the news that week. It's lively, it's fun, it's informative. What more could you want? So search The Y Curve in your favorite podcast app or go to ycurve.com to listen.